Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am the Zany Mystic and your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is Lorna Saltzman. Lorna Saltzman has been an environmental activist, writer, lecturer, and organizer for 40 years and is a graduate of Cornell University. In 1985, she co-founded the New York Greens, later called the New York Green Party, and in the late 1990s, she ran for Congress and the U.S. Senate on the Peconic Greens and Green Choice parties, respectively. In 2002, she was the Green Party candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives for Long Island and New York. In 2004, she sought the U.S. Green Party's nomination for president. In addition to her numerous published articles in such publications as The Ecologist, Business and Society Review, Index on Censorship, and New Politics, all available on her website, she has lectured extensively at major universities and private schools in the New York and New Jersey region and participated frequently in radio and TV panel discussions and debates. She is a member of the New York Academy of Sciences, and in 2000, she received the International Earth Day Award from the Earth Society Foundation for her environmental writing and activism. She is married to composer-writer Eric Saltzman. Let's welcome Lorna to the show now. Hi, Lorna. How are you?
Hi. I think probably my husband is maybe more famous out in California than me, at least maybe in the musical community.
I have heard of him.
He just has a new book out.
Oh, what is it?
It's called The New Music Theater.
The New Music Theater. I'm writing this down now because I want to look into it. I always get so many tips on good books from the guests.
Well, it's just, it isn't officially out, but it's printed, and I think
okay.
the publication date is like November 5th or something like that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And it's the first book of its kind. I mean, it's a good chance for me to promote it. I think there's people out there that would enjoy it, because my husband was a music critic on the New York Times and also the Tribune, and has been active in music theater. So.
Oh, how wonderful.
And,
maybe we should talk about him tonight.
Yeah, maybe. That's right. Well, he went to bed already.
Oh, he did. We could have put him on the other line and gotten a three-way conversation going.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Jeez,
so, anyway, so it's called The New Music Theater, Seeing the Voice, Hearing the Body, and meaning that it's a music theater which involves all kinds of other arts, performance art, extended voice, instrumental, vocal, theater, dance, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah, so that's, I think it's the first of its kind.
Well, what is it focusing on? I mean, it's not a critique, is it?
No, it's a historical, recounting of the origins and the development of music theater, which is neither musical comedy nor opera.
Uh-huh.
But I think to familiarize yourself with it, the best example might be Weill and Brecht, Three Penny Opera, something like that.
Uh-huh.
But it includes people like Meredith Monk and Laurie Anderson and, all kinds of other people.
You know, it's funny because I just saw on PBS station last night with Bill Moyers, he was talking about the economy and stuff, but they had a little tiny segment on Mark Johnson, who started the Playing for Change movement. Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't.
This is an amazing thing. It took him 10 years to get these street players together, but they come from all over the world. And he went into Southern Africa where one of the best musicians lives, and they're in poverty there. And they were so impressed with, the music that he's starting a school called Playing for Change School.
Yeah.
And it was a fascinating piece anyway, so those who can catch it might find it of interest. It was fascinating music and an interesting experience, so.
Anyway, that was just to get a little promotion about the book.
Yes.
But it's interesting because one of the things that I've given a lot of thought to is the issue of intellectuals and artists getting involved in social and political change.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are these individual examples like what you just mentioned, the fact is that when you read and hear intellectuals and artists say at parties, conferences, meetings, performances, events, and so forth, the issue of environment is absent.
Mm.
I mean, it's essentially absent from the intellectual discourse, pardon the expression, in the United States.
Mm.
And this is not true in other countries. It's only in the United States. And when you read even the most progressive magazines, particularly on the left, but even just liberal progressive magazines,
mm-hmm.
Dissent, for example, which is, I think, the best magazine on the left in this country.
Dissent?
Dissent, yeah.
Dissent, okay.
What did I say? Dissent.
I just accent. Wanted to make sure I got it right.
Yeah, Dissent. It's a fine magazine, and willing to print a lot of things and do critiques of coming from a very different direction of
mm-hmm.
others. But there's nothing on environment.
Oh.
There's nothing. I mean, the latest issue has something on populism in Latin America.
Oh, good.
And I was particularly interested in this because about a year ago, the International Herald Tribune published an article by Noam Chomsky on the new left in South America.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Chavez in Venezuela, Lula in Brazil,
mm-hmm.
Correa in Ecuador, and presumably Bachelet in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this article, and, you know, like this is the millennium, where, you know, the left is finally taking over. Well, I looked at it, and as an environmentalist, I said, this is crap. I mean, no one, and then I responded, and I started talking about each of those countries, what was actually happening. And that, you know, that's like full speed ahead with development and, you know, and oil pipelines and mining and timber and genetically modified food and the whole thing.
God.
Every one of these countries.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's absolutely untrammeled, you know, development. The only difference is that instead of, you know, going to the IMF or the World Bank, they're doing it on their own.
Oh, dear.
but it's exactly, they didn't, unfortunately, the Herald Tribune didn't publish my response. But it's on my website. And I don't know if you announced my website to people.
Go ahead and do that now so people can.
All right, www.lornasalzman.com. Lorna Salzman being one word.
Lorna, this is a very dangerous time we live in. It seems like we all have our heads in the sand about ecological issues. This is a very delicate balance that the planet maintains, and we are so out of balance right now, aren't we?
Well, it's worse than that, and I mean the fact is that if it weren't for human interference in ecosystems, particularly with things like synthetic chemicals and nuclear power and genetic, if it weren't for those major interventions, the fact is that the Earth is quite resilient.
Right. Right.
I mean, that if you look at and this also, if people go to my website and read my little book there called Politics as If Evolution Mattered, one of the things I talk about is this resiliency. And then if you go to places where there's been cataclysms, say Mount St. Helens or, you know, or earthquakes and volcanoes and all kinds of floods and so forth, the fact is that life comes back.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not that it you know, that it disappears completely, but, you know, but when humans produce or create conditions for which the Earth has never had the ability to regenerate or
right.
to counteract,
right.
Like digging up uranium. I mean, uranium is under the Earth. Well, it's fine. Under there, it's fine. If you don't mine it, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's only when you bring it to the surface.
Right. Right.
You know, so that's...
And then what happens to the spent uranium that is used by these atomic power plants that's put into barrels that has a half... I don't know, what's the half-life on it?
Well, it depends on the fission product. It depends. It's a different kind of thing. It depends on whether it's fission products like strontium and cesium, which are direct product of fission, have relatively short half-lives, like 30 to 40 years. So in that period of time, half of what there is decays, and then another 30, 40 years, half of that decays. So generally speaking, they say after 20 half-lives, most of it has disappeared. But the thing is, the elements with a shorter half-life are more dangerous to handle or be near because they're giving off more radiation per unit of time.
Yeah.
So then you get the stuff like plutonium-238, which has a half-life of 250,000 years.
Oh, my Lord.
But you could hold a lump of plutonium if you didn't, if it weren't in powder form and you didn't inhale it. You could hold it in your hands because the radiation is being given off very slowly over that period of time.
All right.
So it's, you know, these are, you know, just little things that people should know. But where was I? I was talking about, well, I started talking about my book and evolution.
Oh, yeah, well, go on,
which is,
talk about your book. That's good.
Well, it's I haven't been able to find a publisher. It started as a book in the 80s about the green movement.
Yeah.
And I wrote it from that point of view and since I had been involved in it. And then I had one chapter in the book that was on ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And then I never was able to find a publisher. So I went back and I looked at the chapter on ecology and I said, you know, this isn't bad. And, you know, no one's going to publish the other. And, you know, everything is changing with the green movement and party, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that chapter and then I started writing, you know, chapters before it and after it and expanding on it. And, you know, and it became this new book.
Okay.
Which is quite a simple primer, I guess you'd call it, on evolution. It's not quite evolution for dummies, but you know.
Something that I could understand.
You know, something that people could understand.
Yeah.
I mean, there are understandable books on evolution, and in fact, and the problem is no one reads them. I mean, and they're fascinating. I mean,
the
thing about evolution is that it is the most fascinating, mysterious, incredible, miraculous thing that is possible to know on the face of the earth.
Huh.
I mean, you know, I'm not trying to make it into a religion or anything like that, but the you know, when you start grasping it and understanding it, everything else sort of becomes clear. In fact, Daniel Dennett even said in one of his books, I forget which one it was, oh, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he said that it's a universal acid, that the concept of evolution, because it eats into everything.
Mm.
And not only eats into everything, but then it takes on everything. It absorbs everything. It casts light on everything.
Mm.
And one of the most important evolutionary biologists, Dobzhansky, said once that nothing in biology makes any sense except in the light of evolution.
Mm.
And it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, to me, the notion, I mean, I suppose you'd call it a spiritual thing, but the notion, the understanding that we're all, you know, that we're all a unity of life, that we're related to every form of life on Earth, that we're, and that we all came from the same origin, from the same cells, essentially.
Yeah. Yes.
Is it an absolutely amazing idea?
That is pretty amazing.
It's a pretty amazing thing. So, you know, and I think, you know, the idea of evolution was not even really new with Darwin.
I mean,
the word evolution, I think he later used it in some of his later writings. But the idea, even the Greek philosopher had this idea of that there were, you know, there was originally a core or something out of which, you know, life came or something like that. But people should be reading some of these books. I mean, they should be reading Ernst Mayr, and they should be, who is like one of the most brilliant writers and thinkers and scientists. He died at the age of, I think, 104, about 5 years ago. We're at work on his 40th book.
Well, who was this again?
Ernst Mayr.
Ernst Mayr.
M-A-Y-R.
Okay.
He was up at Harvard.
All right.
He started out as a bird, an ornithologist, I think, in New Guinea somewhere.
Huh.
And then it's the most brilliant mind. I mean, reading his books, and he writes on science, and he writes about the philosophy of science and evolution and everything. And he's the most amazing mind. It's breathtaking, and it sort of makes you say, to say to yourself, oh my God, you know, how could anyone be this brilliant? But he is comprehensible. And then, of course, Richard Dawkins, who was a delightful writer, and his book called The Blind Watchmaker, which is, I think, pretty good as a kind of basic evolutionary textbook. It's quite comprehensible, and he's lively, and he's very and opinionated and funny, and also a brilliant mind. So those two writers, and there are many others, you know, that have written about evolution and Darwin, who've written textbooks and so forth. There's a guy at Stony Brook here, Doug Futaima, who's written some very important books and some textbooks. But Mayer and Dawkins are, you know, the places to really start.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but don't you know that people get all of their information from the television and from cell phones?
Yes.
They no longer need to go to books.
Yes.
Why bother with books?
Well, they can go to the internet and go to my website and read about evolution. No, it is very sad. But,
yes.
You know, whatever the reasons are,
yes.
the point is that not only is there no discourse in the intellectual community about environment or ecology, but the awareness of evolution and how it permeates everything, and basically you can't understand anything about ecology or environment without understanding evolution. And all the most departments in universities, the departments are called Department of Ecology and Evolution because they go together.
Well, then what would you say, what category would you put Al Gore and his global warming stuff into?
Environmental.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, environmental. I'm talking here to kind of the basic lack of scientific literacy. I mean, we all know, everyone has been moaning about, you know, science and math and all the, you know, and this and that and the other thing.
Yeah.
And it has two aspects. I mean, it has one, the academic aspect of there's no mandatory environmental studies and so forth and
so on.
Yes. Which is really tragic.
Yes.
And inexcusable.
Yes.
But the other aspect has to do with natural history and nature and exposure to nature.
Yes.
And that's pretty much left to people on their own to do as individuals. And the fact is that, you know, small children love nature.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they have no fear of bugs, snakes, nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And speaking of firsthand experience, now, you spent many years going out into other countries and studying birds and animals and so on and so forth. In fact, I was just reading a little bit of one of your trips into Peru, and I thought, gee, this is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that was the one we just did in July.
Oh, it is. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
What?
Well, sure. I mean,
because
for those of us who will never get to Peru and get to see some of these beautiful creatures that you got to see.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You don't have to go to Peru to, you know, you can do just what's in your, you know, in your backyard.
Yeah.
And in fact, Gilbert White, who lived in the 18th century in England, he was a local minister and in Selborne, a little town. I don't know where exactly in England, probably outside of London somewhere. And he never left Selborne.
Mm-hmm.
In this teeny little town, it probably had 150 people in it.
Huh.
And he wrote a natural history of Selborne, and basically it was just about the plants and animals, and you know, in his neighborhood, But this is true anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, really, what ecology is about, it's not necessarily understanding the vast ecosystems of the world, the climate and the tides and the oceans and everything. It's basically because what ecology is about relationships.
Right.
And it's about how species interact with each other. They eat each other, or they try to defend each other from each other, or they interact, and so they live in what's called a biotic community. And we all have biotic communities at our back doors.
Hmm.
And the problem is that people don't even bother to find out what the things are that are growing or living right outside their back doors, and they don't look.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's really quite amazing because before my husband and I were bird watchers, we started watching birds. Well, first we started with hunting mushrooms, and then we went on to birds in the 60s, and of course, before you actually are into this, you don't see the things. I mean, sure, people might see blue jays or cardinals or robins.
Yeah.
Sure, you know what, and they know what that is. But the fact that there are, you know, hundreds of other birds and other things around.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, when you notice them, your whole world is opened up.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I remember in the 60s, my husband, he went to Europe one summer without me, and I was sitting out here, and I saw our house in Long Island, reading or something. And all of a sudden, this little teeny bird with a yellow with a black mask sort of flits by me and lands in a tree and bush or something. And I say to myself, oh, my God. You know, I mean, a yellow bird with a black mask?
Yeah.
I'd never seen it before.
Huh.
Well, it turns out it's one of the most common birds out here.
Oh.
The yellow-throat, a warbler. It's extremely common.
Oh.
And a nest right near, you know, but I had never seen it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I remember us driving down to the shore and seeing snowy egrets. And we decided that they must be accidental releases from Disney World. Because there was no other explanation of why these exotic white birds would be out there in the middle of the marsh, right?
That's funny.
But, I mean, this is what I'm saying. You're saying before this happens to you, you're not aware that these things have been there all the time.
Oh.
And that they're there to for you to look for them, to discover them.
So are you suggesting we should open our eyes and pay more attention to our
surroundings? Well, it's not only opening. I used to get the impression like people would join the Sierra Club and they go on these wonderful hikes and they get all their good boots and their backpack and they'd, you know, in a tent and everything.
Yeah.
And they'd go hiking on trails and, you know, the Sierras or the Rockies.
Yeah.
But do you think that any of them would bother to try to identify the plants they saw along the way?
Well,
I mean, they might
not.
If they saw, you know, an animal. Sure, they'd be interested in everything. But I bet none of them, or very few of them, would ever even bother to, you know, take a book along and look at the actual plants and flowers and try to identify them.
And
they don't do that. They just hike.
There's a wealth of plants and flowers that are.
Well, of course there is. I mean, I'm saying that. But even outside your back door,
And today, I just want to throw this out there because you might be able to shed some light on it. I have no idea how this happened. I live more or less out in the country, in gold country, in the Sierras. And I happened to look up, and there was some little white fleck of something blowing in the wind in the sky. And I thought, what is that? It's just hovering. And then the glint of the sun came down, and there was a spider web that went from one pine tree at least 50 or 60 feet to another pine tree, and that was some little piece of fluff that had caught on it.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
And I had no idea how the spider either flew to the other tree or rode a bird over there or took the wind or actually let himself down and walked all the way. It was amazing.
Well, they spin the thread, and then the wind blows the thread to another tree, and that's how they get to the tree.
It was amazing. I mean,
yeah.
But if you weren't looking up and looking for things,
you wouldn't have seen it.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
And it might have been a mighty big spider.
Well, look down at the ground. You see faster than spiders that live in the ground. You see these holes, and they have kind of white threads and things, and, you know, many spiders that live in the ground. Do you know that most spiders, if not all of them, build a new web every day?
No.
Yes.
I thought they just kept repairing the old one.
No.
Oh.
No, they don't. They build a new one every day.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't that? They work very hard.
I guess. And the bees, you know, the bees are disappearing, supposedly. Well, in reality, they're disappearing in certain places, right?
Yeah, the honeybees,
honeybees.
They have problems, yeah.
But there were two bushes, two wild, I guess they're weeds to most people, but they have flowers on them. Literally jam-packed with wild bees. I mean, they were just so happy. They were humming along, and they just had a feast over there. It was wonderful. I was marveling at it. I said, oh, what a beautiful sight to be bees.
Well, you've got great stuff out west. You have completely different things than we have.
Yeah.
Things that are, on the other side of the Rockies and the other side of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
Those are, everything is very different there.
Yeah.
And particularly in California.
Yeah,
and so you have, and of course, and you have very rich, plant life and stuff, even much more than we do at the same latitude. To find that kind of diversity, you'd have to go here. You'd have to go down, you know, down to the south in Florida.
Oh,
but you have a lot there because California has a great diversity of habitats.
Mm.
You've got the coastline.
Mm-hmm.
You've got desert.
Mm-hmm.
You've got mountains.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? I just heard a very loud explosion.
Uh-oh. I hope a war hasn't been declared yet.
I don't know. Maybe it's just a...
Wouldn't that be awful?
Thunderstorm. I hope so.
Could be.
It's very loud.
Oh, geez.
Pretty scary. Okay,
well you're all right.
So where was I now? Oh, but those flowers and the diversity of California is very, very impressive. So there's lots of things to see there. And
well, one thing I've noticed, and maybe this is going a little bit off topic, but when I look up, I have noticed for quite a long time now there are chemtrails in the sky. And
yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with those, but they're the trails from the jets that seem to be distributing some kind of something to promote the ozone layer.
I think I've read about that.
And I'm just wondering how that's going to impact everything.
I don't know. I mean, it's just there's so many things.
Doesn't it seem that we're just like a tight wound up spring, waiting like a watch just waiting to go off?
But you know, I have to say, I just unplugged my computer, so in case it is a thunderstorm, I fried a modem once because I didn't unplug it.
I hope it tasted good. Did you have it done?
Right, deep fried. Now, what was I saying?
You think that you're going to say something about?
None of this is new. Okay, I mean,
well, there's never been so many people on the earth before, have there?
Well,
that's new.
We were overpopulated even in the 70s. That's not even, you know, I'm saying in terms of the environmental problems.
Oh.
All the problems that we have now were around when we first started discussing them in the late 60s and 70s. Okay?
Well, all right.
And through the 1970s, there isn't one problem. I'm trying to think of one problem that didn't exist then.
Genetically modified food?
So, I got involved in that.
In the ocean?
Around 1976 or 7, when I was working for Friends of the Earth in New York, that was when they started promulgated the guidelines for doing research
mm-hmm.
on genetic modification.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this huge thing, and they had this big meeting out in Asilomar in California.
Mm-hmm.
And to promulgate guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a thunderstorm. So,
okay, good.
And luckily I just unplugged. I hope the phone doesn't
good.
Go off.
You'll be all right.
But anyway, they promulgated the guidelines.
Yes.
The thing is that they did it illegally because before you release guidelines, you're supposed to do an environmental impact statement.
Oh.
Based on the risk that you might see or project, then you do the guidelines. They
right.
didn't do an EIS. And so we, that is Friends of the Earth, thanks to Dave Brower and other people, we took them to court.
Uh-huh.
And we filed a lawsuit against like 8 different agencies
uh-huh.
Saying that they were violating, you know, this law, that law, that, blah, 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 you know,
yeah.
8 different laws, and that they had to do an EIS.
Yeah.
And the problem was that we could not find scientists to take the suit forward, who would be willing to testify in court.
And if you could, they could have been bought off or killed.
Well, yeah, they were bought off, but the problem is a lot of them were already doing work in that area.
Yeah.
And so they had conflicts of interest.
Of course.
You know, some people were pretty honest. There were people like Mark Lepe out in California.
Yeah.
I think he's dead, unfortunately.
See, I told you they got him.
Well, there were a few, you know, very good people.
Yeah.
And at Friends of the Earth, one of the volunteers there, Francine Simmering, formed something called the Coalition for Responsible Genetics. And she recruited Nobel Prize winners and lots of scientists from MIT and Harvard and others. You know, to try to slow this caravan or whatever you call it, this
avalanche.
Runaway train out of control. But we're never able to do it.
No, and hence we have a seed bank in Switzerland, isn't it?
So, an interesting side story on this is that Dave Brower, who was always very prescient and way ahead, you know, and understood these issues. I had heard that there had been a meeting in California and that some of his even close friends, like Paul Ehrlich, whose wife Ann was on our board, and other people, when he went out to California, where Friends of the Earth had their main office, apparently there was some kind of meeting in someone's living room where the scientists all sat around to try to get Friends of the Earth to drop the lawsuit.
Really?
Including, you know, people like Ehrlich and so forth. But he wouldn't do it.
Huh.
He stayed firm.
Huh. Was that from their belief that GM food was a positive thing, or just...
Well, it wasn't food at that time. It was just the research.
Okay.
It was the research.
Well,
and,
of course, now it has the potential to be a devastating problem for life in general.
Well, it is devastating, and the reason, you know, I'm not a scientist, but to me it is so... counter-evolutionary.
Exactly.
I mean, because it circumvents natural selection.
Yes.
And it puts the power to design, you know, in the hands of people for ulterior motives, for reasons that are not the reasons of nature, which natural selection follows, but
right.
unnatural selection.
Well, and that's all goes back to the globalization you were talking about earlier.
So,
you know, rich nation loaning a country seed banks of genetically modified seeds.
So that's because they own them, and that's the whole issue there about patents and control.
Oh my God.
And that is, there's no question that that's a big risk,
and that's
the political dimension of genetic modification, but the scientific dimension of it is really also compelling. because it really is. I mean, what you have when you have evolution and natural selection, you have, you know, organisms which are adapted to, you know, certain conditions.
Yes.
And that and if the conditions remain stable, then the organisms can, you know, reproduce and survive.
Yeah.
And that if conditions change,
yeah,
then those that are most adapted will be the ones to reproduce and survive. But unfortunately, the unnatural selection means that you are changing the genome, the genetic makeup of something, not through the process of natural selection.
Right.
Not through a process that is partly random and partly not random.
Right.
But you're changing it to fit human needs.
And on top of that, the seeds that are produced from these plants don't propagate.
And they don't propagate, yeah.
And what happens? What happens to the entire... You know, and the compatibility issues of genetically modified food with the human body, and now, as I understand it, it's common practice to irradiate food, which...
Oh, don't get me started on that! I worked for a group that fought it in the mid-80s called Food and Water Incorporated.
Mm.
It's not there's a group now called Food and Water, it's not the same group, but I was the executive director of that, and we did a big report for the New Jersey legislature on food irradiation, saying that, giving all the reasons why it was a very bad idea.
Yeah.
But
you find that all of these agencies now today are pretty much in the pocket of the corporations, the EPA and all the places that are, all of those agencies that were set up and designed to protect us are now simply rubber stamping those things that are extremely harmful for us.
Yeah, well, they only get away with it. They don't always get away with it. It depends on, you know, the administration and the president.
Well, look at the one we've got now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, yes, exactly.
Jeepers creepers.
Yeah, jeepers creepers.
Card blocks.
No, there's going to be a lot of, repairing, picking up the pieces, hopefully, if Obama gets elected.
Is it even possible?
So, who knows? But you want to know something?
What?
I mean, I'm not cynical at all. I'm cynical about government.
Yeah.
I'm not cynical about people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When I have arguments with people about whose fault and this and that and the other thing, I say,
yeah,
you know, people can make choices, and people can educate themselves, and
yeah,
people, you know, and to me, the opportunities that have been missed. Oh, what I was talking about before, in terms of education, in terms of the media, and in terms of the fact that because a large part of the progressive or liberal community, those are, you know, peace and social justice people and so forth, really think of environment as just sort of another entry on the list of things, you know, and they don't see it as all pervasive.
It is all pervasive.
Of course, it's all pervasive, and not only that, it completely subsumes all the social justice issues that they're concerned about. But they don't see it that way.
Oh my God.
And you still have people, particularly on the left, but also even in the religious community.
Oh my God.
For whom, you know, the peace and social justice things are the primary things, and you know, environment, well, we'll, you know, we'll do our best with that, but, you know. And,
let's put a bone over our shoulder and deal with that later.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And this is very disturbing.
It is.
And it's out of ignorance. It's because people are not, you know, ecologically educated and informed.
And the media isn't exactly giving us accurate information.
Well, not only that, I mean, well, the media doesn't want to print bad news because
they'll
lose advertisers.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, you could, I mean, and it's almost, and there's nothing but bad news. If you could, every day you could print a giant newspaper covering all the environmental disasters everywhere in the world and cover nothing else.
Oh, yes.
And you'd fill up the pages.
Yes.
I mean, that's all there is. I mean,
yes.
You know, that's really all that is happening in the world,
is
environmental disaster.
It's terrifying when you start thinking about it, and the dead zones in the oceans, that's another one.
But it's, and I have to say to myself, you know, the failures are the educational system, you know, the media, and ultimately the individual who really has to educate herself.
Yes.
And has to elevate this issue to the center of public discourse. And the intellectuals in this country still don't do it.
No, and what's it going to take? It looks like we're going to have to be backed up against the wall by nature herself.
Well, that's, everyone says that, you know, when there's a big collapse and people will take it seriously.
Well,
but even that, but you still have the deniers. Yes, we know they're the neocons and the right-wingers and everything like that. But even in supposedly educated circles, I have people saying to me, well, is this true? Is this really happening? And what do you, you know, in other words, they're still uncertain.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I mean, you know, even with global warming, I take it you do agree that that is something that's occurring today, regardless of the cause of it, right?
Well, we know the causes. We're further gone than even the scientists will say publicly.
Well, they can't. Well, and the administration was using lawyers to X out anything that sounded scary.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
everything's all right, folks. Look the other way. The economy's fine.
But there's many places for the public to get information.
Well,
the point is that the information is out there.
Yes.
It's out there in journals. It's out there. It's on the web, and I'm talking about serious information. I'm not talking about, you know, wacky.
You know, I know, crazy,
wacky stuff.
Well, where would you suggest on the internet for instance, find out the truth?
Well, there are many. I'll give a couple of the best place to go. I would say would be Climate Equity. Climate Equity is a website. It's based in Australia, and they produced what I think is the definitive comprehensive report on global warming, which is called Climate Code Red.
All right.
A sustainability emergency. It's been updated, and it's now in book form, and I think they're trying to get an American publisher.
Okay.
But in any case, it's available on the web.
Okay, good.
It can be downloaded.
Okay, good.
So Climate Code Red, if people go Google it or whatever and get to Climate Equity, they also, and they have, I think they have some kind of listserv, too.
Good,
So I would say that's number one source.
Okay, number one.
Okay. Number two is called, there are two more websites. One's called realclimate.org.
Okay.
And the other is Climate Progress.
Okay.
I think it's org.
Now. Real Climate.
Realclimate.org is a huge website where they publish everything from little gossipy snippets of news to the latest scientific research papers.
Wonderful.
And then you have scientists debating. They have a whole section. I mean, you can go, there are many, many links to news and research and this and that and the other thing.
Wow.
But they also have debates of the scientists back and forth about new research.
Oh, that's
so realclimate.org is very authoritative.
Oh, good.
And then there's a place called
climateprogress.org.
And I believe that's more oriented to news and new developments and things like that.
Wonderful.
So those three are the best sources, in my opinion.
Well, that's why people should listen to these radio shows, especially mine.
Yes.
So they can find out where to get
this information.
So they
can find out where to go, yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us because, you know, I wouldn't have known any of this either.
Yeah.
I learned just like everybody else does, and I soak it up like a sponge.
So, yeah.
you know.
Well, those are definitely three. You should make a note of them. And
I did.
Every program, you can repeat it.
Yes, I will do that, Lorna. I will do that because these are really vital issues to all of us.
But it's my hope that individuals will, you know, will not shy away from science. I mean, there's been a very big bit backlash against science and scientists for whatever reasons. Now, I understand we don't like, you know, genetic meddling, and we don't like nuclear power and toxic chemicals. And there are all these bad things that, you know, that technology has brought us.
Yes.
But that's very different from science as a discipline.
Right.
You know, as a process. And people need to respect science. I mean, first of all, it's fascinating. You're learning about life and everything, you know, all
That's
life
true.
Forms and how things work and so forth and so on. One would think you'd want to learn about things like that, not just about what the real estate prices are or how many calories a hamburger has.
Or who
you know?
Wins on American Idol.
So, that's right. But for people who are, you know, sensitive and sensible and take these things seriously, they have to get over this distrust of science.
Yeah.
And that's extremely important. And unfortunately, there have been backlashes against it from, well, not just from the creationists, that's a whole different thing, but from the left. I mean, what we call the postmodern deconstruction, all those people who see science as, quote, culturally determined, unquote.
Mm.
In other words, this notion of that, you know, there's no such thing as truth or facts or whatever, and it's all biased depending on who you're talking to or what you're reading and so forth. And it's very bad, and it's turned a lot of people against science. And some of the worst offenders in this respect are the feminists.
They're
left-wing feminists. There's a wonderful book called Biopolitics, and the editor of it, or one of the, is Vandana Shiva, who's great, who I love. She's actually an Indian scientist and politically very astute.
Uh-huh.
It's a collection of essays by English, American, and French feminists, postmodern essays, and I have to say that this is one of the most hilarious party books you will ever read in your life.
Really? Tell us
about it. Yeah. I bring it out at parties and start reading, you know, reading some of the paragraphs, and you just have to roll in the aisle.
Oh, that's funny.
So it is funny. It's extremely funny.
Oh,
but
golly.
But the point is that it's people like this that have caused this distrust of science, and it's very, very, very bad, and it has to be overcome.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this famous thing that happened about... maybe 6 years, 7 years now ago, Sokal's hoax?
No.
Alan Sokal is a mathematician at the City College, and he's also a leftist, or I don't know if he's a Marxist, but he's very left, socialist, whatever. And he wrote an article with one of these long, newfangled postmodern titles, you know, towards a new hermeneutics of this and that. Yeah, I mean, I don't even remember what the title was.
Uh-huh.
If you Google Sokal's hoax, you can get it, you can download it, I'm sure. Anyway,
okay.
He wrote this long article, and he submitted it to a magazine in New York that comes out of NYU, or City College, rather, called Social Text.
Okay.
And the editors, one of whom I won't mention, but who I used to be sort of friendly with, swallowed it whole. And they published it without a second thought.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And exactly.
When
it turned out Sokal wrote this as it's a complete hoax. I mean, it's actually, he completely, you know, completely fooled them.
Wow.
And then, of course, when it was exposed, and this was in the New York Review or other places, you can imagine the furor and the embarrassment and so forth. And the interesting thing is, when I heard about this, I downloaded it and I started reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to about page 10 or 12, I forget, you know, and I said to myself, well, this is clearly a hoax.
Huh.
How could anyone not see it as a hoax?
Yeah.
I mean, it was so clear to me that it was written as a hoax, but because it used the jargon,
oh yeah,
it was just, you know, it was just absolutely, it's marvelous. Really.
Well, that's the Republican Karl Rovian tactics.
But this is the left.
You say it, and it's true. You know?
This is the left.
Yeah, oh, well,
and don't get me started on the left. People think I'm a right-wing neocon redneck racist because I've always been after the left.
Oh.
But the left has been left behind, as they say. The left has been consistently, and I say this because I followed them for 40 years,
yeah,
has been very antagonistic to environmentalism and antagonistic to the notion of stopping growth, and antagonistic to the notion that there's anything wrong with technology, and that Barry Commoner was part of this too, and he fooled a lot of people.
Yeah, those are all terrible ideas.
they were really terrible. But Barry Commoner's his belief, and he was a Marxist, was that that there was no such thing as environmental problems.
I
did a critique of his once. I read, because I followed him. I followed what he wrote, and also at his 80th birthday celebration in Cooper Union, he got up and he said, we don't have to worry about nature. Nature can take care of itself.
Oh, dear.
All we need is the right technology.
Oh,
and this was always his position.
Oh, that's scary.
And the position of the left on growth, technology, environmentalism, et cetera, was always that there would be technological solutions,
yeah,
and that the problems were only because of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that when workers owned the means of production,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera,
oh, yeah,
all the problems would disappear.
Yeah, like they never had before when the workers owned the production.
So that, yeah,
just,
funny they never did, right?
You just have a new boss like the old boss.
So, that was the left's, and I have many arguments about this. And that sort of receded. That was, in the 70s and 80s. And it's a little bit less hostile now, but it hasn't quite gone away.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't quite gone away.
Mm.
And it's very bothersome. But, I mean, the left, at least in this country, has always tried to fit everything into their Procrustean bed. In other words, to the extent that they acknowledged there were environmental problems,
yeah,
it was only because of the failure that they didn't have socialism. It was a failure of the it was always a political and ideological interpretation. And they still sort of go for that.
Yeah.
It's amazing how ideologues just hang on to their ideology.
Well, that's kind of part of an old paradigm, isn't
yeah.
it? It's falling apart.
Well, everyone does it, I guess.
Well, you're right.
You have to, but not scientists. And it's very interesting because Conrad Lorenz, who was the first sort of animal behaviorist or ethologist, said the first thing he does when he gets up in the morning is to discard a pet hypothesis.
That's great.
Which I like very much. And,
oh, that's funny.
It is funny. And but political ideologues, whether right or left, don't do that. They cling to it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even libertarians. I have a friend who's a libertarian. I know some people who are. You know, and I'm sympathetic to them because they're very tolerant of dissent and much more than others. But they have huge blind spots about the free market and about environment they don't even discuss. It doesn't even exist for them.
Wow.
And, and some of these people are just going to hold on to their thing. To, the death grip.
Yeah.
And the Marxists do it, and the neocons do it, and, and it's just awful. And,
Who does have a reasonable grasp of what's happening today?
Science. The scientists.
Okay, so,
the scientists.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's
well,
like.
Why aren't we hearing? Well, of course.
Well, we're hiring from, we know Jim Hansen, and we know Edward Wilson.
Okay.
And Gus Speth isn't a scientist, but at least he's, They're not speaking out as loudly and as they should and in the places they should. I just sent off an email to Gus Speth and Jim Hansen and George Woodwell, and I said, because I had gotten from someone else a declaration signed by like 100 Australian scientists saying, we're on the edge of the precipice on global warming.
Wow.
So I forwarded this to them, and I said, why aren't we doing this in this country?
Yes.
I mean, individual scientists like Hansen are speaking out.
Yeah.
But the scientific community I mean, I met Wilson at the New York Academy of Sciences last year, and afterwards I said to him, we need a million scientists march on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that might do it. But they, you know...
Do they get ostracized from their, from the scientific...
Well, most of them have tenure,
okay.
And if they, and a lot of them are emeritus anyway, like,
okay.
Like Wilson. So they have nothing, they're not losing anything.
Well, then it seems that they need to be encouraged to speak out because we're not getting the message.
So, they have to step up to the plate. I mean, Hansen,
yeah.
I have to say Hansen is great.
Okay.
I mean, he's a very shy man. He's a very shy and modest person. This is, he's not, you know, and he's been saying this since, you know, since the 80s.
Wow.
But now he actually will talk at rallies.
Oh.
And he's, like, he's really, you know, and you want to know why?
Why?
Because he's scared shitless.
Oh, really?
Well, of course.
Well, tell me what he sees that you agree with that we should know about.
Well, first of all, you got to go to his website, go to the internet, and get, you know, read his paper. His papers are technical papers.
Okay.
However, what he's done, this is very interesting, he has written long personal letters to the heads of state all over the world.
Really?
Germany, Japan, Brazil, you know, all over.
Uh-huh.
And saying to them, and the first thing he says is, we have to shut down coal. We have to stop coal in its tracks. If there's no carbon sequestration, then there never will be anyway.
Yep.
We know that.
Yep.
It certainly isn't now. No more coal.
Yes.
Okay, so you put that against, you know, Obama's clean coal. Put it against Natural Resources Defense Council, an Environmental Defense Fund, and World Resources Institute or whatever.
Yeah.
All of them are supporting carbon trading. Cap and trade.
Yep, yep.
It's a total scam.
Yes, yeah.
It's just an excuse to let the coal plants continue to operate.
Wow.
And when we should be going for carbon taxes to keep the price of energy high.
Yes.
And oil, get that oil back up there to $5 or $6 a gallon, and use the revenues, rebate the revenues to the public.
Developing other alternative forms of energy?
Well, sure, we should, but now that the price of oil is down so low, it's disadvantageous. No one wants to put money into other forms of energy while oil is so cheap.
I know.
So we have to get the price of oil higher.
Well, they're cutting back production, so it will go up. And besides which, after the elections, we know that they're going to turn off the pump, and it's going to go back up to where they want it.
Well, let's hope so. But, you know, the clean coal is still out there. The Apollo Alliance, you've heard of them, right?
No.
Well, it doesn't matter. Apollo Alliance is, I don't know what you call it. They've got a whole bunch of, you know, big names on their board, like Robert Redford and Van Jones, this black leader, and who's head of Green for All or Green Jobs or whatever. They've got all the, you know, all them people from unions and so forth. The Apollo Alliance is basically how to reindustrialize this country. It's not how to prevent global warming, it's how to reindustrialize the country.
Well, good Lord.
And they're supporting coal. And I just sent out this thing I got from someone sent me about the Apollo, and it says, we will need to rely on coal for the foreseeable future.
That's ridiculous.
Well, of course it's ridiculous, but this is what's being said.
Jeepers, creepers. What, are these people living in the Dark Ages?
Yes, they are living in the Dark Ages. They are living in the Dark Ages. But you want to know something?
What?
These are not environmentalists. That's the difference. This is the difference.
Oh.
I mean, it's the difference between people who come out of the social justice movement, all the other movements.
Yeah.
Okay? Who are, you know, maybe they're, I shouldn't say they're uninformed. They know what's going on.
Yeah.
But they don't really, that isn't their first concern. Their first concern is jobs, relieving poverty, and all this.
But they never want to relieve poverty. It's always about setting up institutions to skim the money off.
Well, they want to save the auto industry. They want to, now there's all this stuff about giving loan guarantees to revive. To revive, Detroit.
Oh yeah! Oh my God, they're pumping.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, we are.
Yeah. And listen, and McCain says, I want to open atomic nuclear plants everywhere.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, Obama doesn't mind them either.
I know. I couldn't believe I heard that.
But you want to know something?
What?
It's us I mean, we do not have, I worked as an environmental professional for, most of, a good part of my adult life.
Yeah.
We do not have an environmental constituency. This is the problem.
Yes.
There's a constituency for, abortion, or for this, and for stem cell research, whatever you want. Yeah. There is no constituency for environmental positions,
and
which people will
top.
Say, I don't give, forget everything else, I'm going to vote on environment.
Right.
That's it,
right. Right.
And that's what we need.
Right.
And whether we're going to get it or not, I don't know. But without it, I don't know that we're going anywhere.
It basically means
that people have to drop everything else, and they have to just face up to the fact that this is a, it's a life and death issue.
And the people are going to have to start dying.
Realize that
it's a life or
death.
Well,
unfortunately, the people that are dying aren't in this country yet. They're in everywhere else.
Yeah, yes, and you've seen them up close and personal.
Yeah. And, well, of course, you bet. And I haven't even seen the worst ones. Africa. Africa is like a failed continent. With maybe two exceptions.
It's just genocide of a scale that's unprecedented.
And it's horrendous. But Asia, you're talking about, Bangladesh going underwater.
Oh.
No one thinks of it as being, as either being imminent. They think technology will save us, or we still have 50 years because of all this business about how we're going to reduce CO2 emissions 80% within 50 years.
By the time
it's over in 10 years.
I know.
It's over in 5 years.
Isn't that funny?
It's the point of, not that the Earth is collapsing in 5 years, but that will be past the point where we can reverse the trend.
Right, exactly.
And no one understands this. I mean, Jim Hansen understands it.
Yes.
He says it.
All right.
But who is listening? Who is reading? Who is understanding this?
I know. Well,
I'm arguing with religious leaders about this.
Oh, good Lord!
I'm arguing, and Van Jones, like, he doesn't let me send him emails anymore. He just said, stop sending me emails. he's a smart guy. He's not dumb and everything, but he's got but he's pushing the green jobs. Okay,
well,
green for all. That renewable energy will produce jobs and lift everyone out of poverty.
Oh.
Well, I say to myself, hey, the same businesses and corporations that have been screwing minorities and the poor up till now, what's going to make them do the right thing now?
Thank you very much. Thank
you. Why are they going to all of a sudden say, hey, yeah, we're going to give all those jobs to the, poor people and the minorities, and we're going to...
We're coming to the end.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's... we covered a lot.
We did. I'll have to get you back again because, you're one of the most fascinating people, and this is a really important subject.
Well, I hope people in California will get off their duffs.
Yeah.
And, this is politics. What I suggested to Gus Beth and a few other people was an environmental pack.
Yeah.
We develop a platform, maybe 6, 8, 10 things, and we circulate it as a petition. People carry it around, and they say to politicians, you support this, I'll vote for you. You don't support it, I'll run against you.
Lorna, thank you so much for being on the show. I wish we had more time. Your website is lornasaltzman.com.
Yes.
And your writings are on there, and I put it on the your bio, which is on the BBS webpage.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Lorna.
Okay, thanks for having me, Lance.
Oh, yes, and I want you back, too.
Okay.
All right.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.